Paul Roberts, and my guest today is Lee Kessler. She's a television actress, screenwriter, playwright, and stage director. Her career in Hollywood and New York spans 35 years and includes dozens of guest starring roles in TV miniseries and movies of the week. She had reoccurring roles in the series Hill Street Blues and Matlock, and was submitted for Emmy nomination twice for her starring roles in the movie Collision Course and the ABC special Which Mother Is Mine. She co-starred with Peter O'Toole in the movie Creator. Lee became the first actress in the world authorized to portray the legendary diarist Anais Nin when her play, Anais Nin, The Paris Years, was produced in New York and Los Angeles with a subsequent tour on the West Coast. She also directed the West Coast premiere of A.R. Gurney's Who Killed Richard Corey. Since the publication of her suspense novels White King and the Doctor and White King Rising, Lee has made numerous radio and TV appearances discussing the book's relevance to the outcome of the War on Terror, and has spoken often at book signings and private readings in New York and Los Angeles. Lee Kessler, welcome to 1550 Today.
Well, Paul, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You've been a very busy person.
Yes, in fact, I was just up in Boston last week in Cape Cod, enjoying your beautiful city.
Yes, and today we're having a return to summer, even though it's the second day of autumn. It's a beautiful day. It's about 85 degrees and kind of humid, so we're going to take it in.
Yeah, enjoy the, what do they call that, autumn summer?
Well, yeah, well, Indian summer.
Indian summer.
Talk about that. Yeah, we haven't had that yet. That comes hopefully a little later in October, because I hate winter.
I know.
But now, you're an actress, so how did you get involved in figuring out what Al-Qaeda may be doing? Was this a thought of yours, that, or is this something that just came about? It sounds like common sense to me, but, you know, it seems like everybody seems to be turning their head to you and saying, boy, what does this girl know that nobody else does?
Well, that's a great question, because I didn't start out to do it. And in fact, when people do read the books, they find it makes such common sense that as the dots are connected and a new picture emerges, they go, wow, that was here all along, but I just didn't see it. But how it happened was after 9/11, I, like everybody, I think, was looking to find how can we help? What exactly is happening to us and how can we help? And as we progressed through the next 1 and 2 and 3 years, I was looking at an America becoming more divided rather than united. And that alarmed me, and I recognized that that could be a symptom of what the military calls a fifth column, which is a force that's inside a country designed to break the solidarity and soften it or split it. And I said, let me look and see if I can bring anything that I have in my background to the table and perhaps figure out what's happening to us. And as you pointed out, I've had a long career in acting, and during that time I had the opportunity to play real people several times. And it's a different type of research, so I decided to do something that's different from what the intelligence community has done. I decided to actually do a character analysis on the real-life mastermind of Al-Qaeda, the Egyptian psychiatrist Ayman al-Zawahiri, just to see if I could figure out what his driving motivation would be. Then I could justify what he'd done in the past in the sense of explain it, but also I could perhaps predict or evaluate what he might do in the future. So I did that. Apparently I nailed it, because I started to make notes of, if I've got it, then this is likely to happen. I'll start to see this manifesting or showing up. And then those things started to actually develop, and we'd start hearing about them in the news, and I went, oh my, I think I have him, and I know what direction he's moving on against Americans inside our country, and I had to figure out a way to get that message out. So I wrote these novels, which are suspense novels, but they reveal this picture that apparently now is almost truer than the facts.
Are you surprised at yourself that you seem to be able to figure this out so simply? Do you look in the mirror and kind of pinch yourself and say, wow, how did I become so smart?
Well, I don't know as I do that, except that I knew that I know my profession and that I have a background in marketing. I have been a student of the mind and human behavior for a long time, and I've had this acting profession. And I said, you know, any of us has a variety of talents, and if we're willing to just take a fresh look and apply them, we don't want to underestimate ourselves and think that we don't have the ability to weigh in and perhaps bring something very valuable to the table. So it was a bit startling when it happened. It was a little bit frightening for a few moments, but then I said, well, if I figured it out, I figured it out, and let me just go forward with it because lots of people might need this information.
Do you think some people think you have a crystal ball somewhere?
Yeah, it's either the crystal ball that comes up, you know, like I get comments a lot with the readers and with interviewers who've read the books who say these books are prophetic. In other words, they're written in advance of the things coming true. But the other side of it is not so much the crystal ball, is that I get the questions from the intelligent or counter-terrorist community of, you have got to be deep in intelligence. I mean, how deep are you? What were you, in a cave with bin Laden when these guys were talking? I mean, how could you know this?
Well, yeah, what is it like to get a call from somebody who's in counterintelligence? We're talking about people that, you know, have years of training and are supposed to be on the top of their game, and here they are calling you, an actress, about a book you wrote. That had to be a little bit kind of scary and maybe satisfying at the same time.
It actually was more the satisfying, and I appreciated the call. For example, Steve Lucky, who's a major counterterrorist specialist in the United States, was turned onto my books by somebody else who had read them. And when he read them, especially the first one, that's when I first met him or came in contact with him, he felt that it was so accurate that the book needed to be read by the community that he works with that is responsible for keeping us safe, particularly here inside the United States, but also abroad. And I actually found it reassuring that the viewpoint isn't so fixated that they would not look to some other sources of input. You know, because, Paul, actors bring something to the table that I hope our intelligence community is working with, and that is creative imagination. Writers would bring the same thing. And so you can have a set of facts in front of you, but you can miss a whole lot. Whereas an actor, if we approach it and we look at it with that creative imagination, we will find or see things or be able to project things into the future that they might miss. So if anything, I was reassured that they were perfectly willing to talk, and I hope that those books get spread throughout that community widely.
Fear for your life that now these books are out there, that maybe the other side, the one that you've been predicting and saying that these things are happening, might decide that you are a danger to their existence or their plans that they have for the world?
Well, you know, I get that question a lot in book signings and occasionally on the air. And initially I was a little bit afraid because I'm actually inside the mind of this guy, and he's a very bad guy, and he's very brilliant. And so I had a little bit of fear at the beginning, but then and my husband brought that up, and I said, well, you know, if the books don't get wide play, it'll never come on his radar screen. If they become bestsellers or are made into motion pictures or whatever, or just move so much in the intelligence or military community, or more importantly, the American people figure out this message, it wouldn't matter. It's too late. The message would be out there because it's actually quite simple. Once you come through the mystery of the books and you see the picture painted from his angle and see the tools with which he's using to bring us down, all of a sudden it seems simple and something that you can face. It isn't as frightening. See, he's using fear and propaganda through public relations to terrify the daylights out of us in a primary economic attack. But it's not scary when you look at it through his eyes and all of a sudden you go, wow. It almost defangs him. So I don't have the fear about it anymore.
Oh, when I read your book, I felt, you know, this is refreshing. Somebody actually know something.
Oh, thank you.
Something that makes sense. Because as you said, they like to play on fear. And if you have information, about what's going on, that fear disappears very quickly because now you understand exactly the situation.
Exactly. What you can face won't take you down, but what you can't face or won't face can. And part of his shell game is to keep us diverted and distracted and compromise the forces inside our country, which should be putting our attention in the right areas, keep them all diverted and distracted or involved in it, and we miss it. But once we do direct our attention, we go, oh, that isn't so bad. That's scary, but geez, now that I'm looking at it, I can handle that. I have faith in the American people.
You say a terrorist is brilliant, and I agree with that. But I also think another strong point of someone that is using terrorism is patience.
Yes.
Because they're very patient. It doesn't matter if it doesn't happen next month or next year or 5 years down the road. The plan is already there.
Yes, particularly with this culture, and not every terrorist is brilliant. Thank goodness some of them are stupid so that we do catch them and so on. But this particular guy is very brilliant. The Israelis had warned us about him back in the 90s, that they felt that he was the most dangerous man on the planet, that he was going to kill a lot of people, and they couldn't figure him out. And if we got him, we should take him down. And that's that patience thing in addition to the brilliance. But he's actually replaying in present time some old scenarios out of the Hashashin age, and they were a group that ruled that sector for over 300 years using suicide missions. They didn't have the bombs like we use them today. They did them a little differently. But he is very, very patient, and this particular enemy is also the Trojan horse inside the United States is very patient. They've been implementing an old Soviet line for half a century now.
Well, I always thought that the basis of crashing planes into the Twin Towers was not really to destroy property or anything. It was to put the American people in a different kind of mindset, to where rather than us fighting the enemy, we start fighting with ourselves, because we're all, like if somebody turned the lights off and we're all running around into each other wondering what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's what they're looking for.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And that's what is the story of the new book, by the way, White King Rising. It is that Trojan horse. It's what's happening inside and how the strategy was to get us tearing ourselves apart. And not just in the political arena. I mean, we have multiple institutions, whether it be education or religion or family. I mean, we're a mess in the sense of us fighting ourselves. And I was interested, like I think you were, is where would that come from? Why all of a sudden did we go from confidence and cooperation and the ability to do and make decisions for the greater good to a group of people in multiple sectors that are on a compete and destroy or a break us down from within? That is why I wanted to look there, and that became the story of this Trojan horse.
Well, I think what's so amazing is the finger pointing.
Yeah, that's part of a diversionary tactic. See, any enemy would know. I mean, I have a natural ability to think like strategically, I think, militarily. But if you're trying to divide and conquer, it's a real good tactic to then get, you know, point a finger at somebody and get them to point fingers at somebody and hope that nobody notices you. These guys are hiding in plain sight, and so are their tactics are pretty obvious when somebody all of a sudden stops the finger pointing and just says, you know, let me just stop that for a minute and look at the arena and see what I see. It's the willingness to look, I think, and stop the pointing.
It comes down again to common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why did you surmise in the book that Osama bin Laden may be in Iran, as the press has just begun to report? And I often thought he had to be somewhere, and it wasn't in a cave somewhere, that he had to be somewhere where he was, you know, quite protected and in a place that would be kind of very hard to get at this kind of person.
Well, it's whatever reasoning you used with that was similar. It became evident to me as I did the research that it was likely that Zawahiri staged a type of coup, if you will, inside Al-Qaeda to assume control. Bin Laden may or may not still be alive, but I assume that he would have been moved. He would be under the control of the doctor, and he would have been moved to a country, again, like you pointed out, where America typically wouldn't have eyes on the ground or the ability to find him, and that he would be secure. He does have medical situations, but he also is under the psychiatric control and medication of this particular guy. So I assumed, well, he's not going to go into Afghanistan. He's not going to go into Pakistan. We'll be looking with everything we got there. He'll go someplace we cannot go, and he'll be held in a secret place there and under Zawahiri's control. He seems to trot him out whenever he needs something from him, if, in fact, he hasn't already filmed it or video or audiotaped it in advance.
Does it matter if Osama bin Laden is alive or dead?
I don't think so. I think both sides stand to gain by us not being able to find him. He's becoming legendary in their community, and as one of the points I made in the book, in the story, is they all of a sudden realize, well, of course, that is a reason for us to keep hunting, too, because we know that he had specific intentions that day.
Because I think that this scenario is much bigger than one or two people that we're talking about here, and that it goes much deeper than that. But as you just stated, that these are symbols for both parties to look at and say, okay, we're on the right track, we're the right ones, and both sides can lay claim to that.
Exactly. And it is bigger than more than one or two people. Although one of the things that I took exception to, and which I think I'm kind of 180-degree opposite from, let's say, perhaps the media or our government or military, is that, if anything, they will be looking at a behavioral analysis, statistical data, to try to figure out what a terror group might do, or radical Islam, or Al-Qaeda, or Hezbollah. And the approach I took was, I realized that those groups exist, and they're being expanded or created, but they're being created by individuals, just like Hitler was the driving force of Nazi Germany, and just like Stalin was a driving force. And I said, let me look for the individual, and since Zawahiri is the mastermind of Al-Qaeda, he's therefore influencing everything they're doing. They are influencing all the other terror groups, and all of those terror organizations, as we figure them out, nonetheless, are affecting all of us everywhere. So I said, let me start with him, because if I can figure out his mind, his intentions, and what he's doing on a mind control basis to get us to go stimulus response, you know, our knee-jerk reactions on things, then perhaps I can provide tools that would enable us to neutralize him, if you will, even in his own community.
Well, some of the names that you mentioned are people that were classic manipulators.
Yes.
They knew how to manipulate people, and if you can manipulate people, you have power.
Well, and yes, and I believe that Zawahiri is as gifted, if not more gifted, than those other two I mentioned, and he's as deadly.
Now, why is Generation Y so important to our survival?
Well, they're the main target, because the baton is about to be passed to them. You know, the World War II generation has almost passed away. The baby boomers are into that time and starting to pass away. And this young generation is going to be receiving not only all the issues and problems we have, but they're coming into their life. It's what they do, the choices that they make, which will determine our future. And I think the Soviets knew that if you can take two generations down back to back, meaning that they're dumbed down and drugged up, you know, or they're undereducated, not prepared for it. You take two generations down in a row, you can take down an adversary. And that was their strategy. I believe this enemy is using that same strategy, and he's bringing the fight right to where the young people live, and they're underprepared for it. That's why I wrote White King Rising with the young heroes, not just Andy Weir, but the football-playing boy from the hood, the young punk from the hood, who actually figures out how to defeat this vile guy, because they're representative of a generation that's caught up in everything that Generation Y is. And I believe that they have been dumbed down and drugged up, and they don't realize they are the target of all of this. If they go, we go. If they win, and I believe they can, we'll win.
So what you're saying here is that Generation Y isn't really ready for this.
Yes, I don't think they are. But I don't think the World War II generation was ready for what they became either. They're known now as the greatest generation. But my viewpoint on it is, you know, prior to what happened at Pearl Harbor and us engaging in that war and what they had to do in whatever arena they fought, they were, you know, doing what these kids were doing. They didn't have the drug influence, but they had their alcohol, and they were going to parties and, you know, dating and planning their future and having fun and going to school. They were doing what any young generation does. But when the incident happened and when the fight came to them, they met the challenge, and then when they came home, they rose up and became what we call the greatest generation and created our greatest prosperity. And I believe this same generation is going to face that same challenge. So maybe they are undereducated in these areas. Maybe they are going to have to handle and end the drug usage and the pharmaceutical usage, which is, you know, slowing them down and draining them and killing them. But I believe, because when I work with them and when I talk to them, they perk up. They know that there's trouble here and that they are coming of age and that something is going to be required of them to maintain a free society. So I'm very optimistic about them if we can just engage them in conversation and say, hey, there's something going on here. But I think when they read the stories, they go, oh, it isn't just that it's going on, it's coming at me. I'm the intended victim. Well, then they really perk up.
Isn't, though, this a little bit different, like when, as you said, that the greatest generation met the challenge and succeeded in World War II, that this war is a little bit different. It's not like you can really define your enemy or country or fighting another person that's wearing a military uniform. It's a little bit different where this could be right outside your doorstep, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a little bit different. It's still a war, but a little bit different than what we've been used to as far as fighting war.
Exactly, and that's why I wrote the books that I did with the drama in them that's there to help people see what you're describing there, but see it dramatized so that if they start to see it in their neighborhood or in their home or on their television or in their community, they go, oh, I see. That would be an example. I see it now happening. Then they can handle it. A lot of things people just let go because they don't necessarily know that there is something sinister there or that there's something that could be compromising them through what you referred to there as that patient enemy. And I learned long ago that you can tell things in fiction that can enable people to see something and understand something and get emotionally involved with something that they otherwise might not face in real life.
Now, that is so true. Ron Serling was famous for that.
Mm-hmm, so many.
Who took a lot of what he believed in and figured he was censored a lot of times, but he did it through fiction. And it is amazing how fiction and storytelling can really educate the populace.
Yeah, totally, and that's why I decided to take that part of my talent and my training and put that into the arena in hopes of, you know, reaching the people of this country. Because I'm after the reader. I trust the reader to go through those books and have some realizations. They'll be entertained. I think they're page turners and fast paced, and the characters are interesting. But beyond that, I think they'll be challenged to think, and I think that they will be looking with a new set of eyes at the circumstances in their community. See, I'm out here in Montana today. Your listeners are going to be all throughout, you know, Boston area and whatnot. But they're going to be looking in their environment. And I think and I hope that my purpose was to raise their awareness, wake them up, so the next time they look, those eyes see something that they didn't see before.
Now, where can people get these books, White King and The Doctor and White King Rising?
They could definitely go to whitekingrising.com, which is my website if they want to read more about it and see interviews and all kinds of stuff on that site. Of course, Amazon, borders.com. If they're not in your local Borders, they can certainly get them. But start with the websites, you know.
Well, I suggest everyone. I'm a history buff, so I enjoyed these books. And they were really right on, and I like common sense. It's a good approach, and It's a very easy read, but it's a read that after you've read the book, you come away a little bit different, and you start thinking a little bit more about things and truly see things as they are and not what they appear to be.
Oh, wow.
And I suggest to get these books, White King or Doctor and White King Rising, or both, and they're by Lee Kessler. And Lee, it was a pleasure having you on 1550 today.
Oh, it's been great being with you, and have a magnificent Indian summer there.
You too, and we'll be back right after this.
Okay, great.
Hey, Lee, we're all set.
Okay, that's awesome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Great interview.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed the stuff, and the books were just fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
You know, right up my alley.
I gathered that, because your insights into them were wonderful, so I appreciated talking to you. It was fun.